apologies, I'm echoing. Not anymore. Welcome. Those who don't know me, I'm Carol Siegel. I'm director of the Freud Museum. It's a real pleasure to see so many of you here tonight, particularly coming out on such a beautiful, rainy evening. I think it's obviously a tribute to the quality of the panel and the discussion that we're going to have, that so many people are here. This is one of the events in conjunction with the exhibition that we have at the moment, Why War, which is surrounding you in the exhibition room at the back and also around the house. And like a lot of museums, we've been marking the centenary of the outbreak of the First World War with this exhibition. But it comes from a slightly different angle from many of the other exhibitions that you may have seen. It takes as its starting point the debate between the correspondence between Freud and Einstein, addressing the question as, you know, why mankind seems to be inevitably fighting and what can possibly be done to prevent war in the future. And that seems as well particularly appropriate with tonight's panel. The exhibition is actually, this is its last week, it closes on Sunday, so if you don't get a chance to have a look at it tonight, you might want to take the chance to come back at the weekend and just have a final look. As well as the sort of objects and artefacts on display, there are a number of pieces of work by artists, including, I would say, one member of our panel, Gabrielle, whose paintings are outside in the hall. Tonight's talk, based on the book by Gabrielle Rifkin and Gianni Pico, The Fog of Peace. And the two authors, Gabrielle and Gianni, have come from very different backgrounds. Gabrielle as a psychotherapist and a specialist in conflict resolution, and Gianni from a background working for the UN, negotiator. I'm sure you'll tell us more about your experiences as we go on. And they're in conversation tonight with John McCarthy, journalist, writer, broadcaster, and as I'm sure many of you will remember, was himself a hostage in Beirut for 5 years. So the three of them are going to be addressing the question of how can you prevent conflict. If you are interested in their ideas and their book, we have copies for sale in the bookshop downstairs, which will be open after the talk, and you'll be very willing to both to sign them and obviously to talk about some of the issues that are raised. I think there's a very interesting quote, in fact, from John McCarthy on the back saying, this book is anything but soft and cuddly. I think that's actually very important as we're all kind of facing or reading about such difficult, intractable seeming issues in the world today, that to have a panel of people who are going to address some of these issues in a way that is really thoughtful and sensitive and recognises how difficult they are will be fascinating. So, over to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Carol. It's a great honour for me to be here with you all at the Freud Museum, sitting between these two people. As Carol mentioned there, in my past was a hostage in Lebanon, and one of the reasons I'm no longer, or got home to be a free man again, was because of the extraordinary efforts of Gianni. And I think we'll touch on that, how he came to do that, what led him to having a successful mission in freeing myself and the other hostages in a little moment. But I think it's a very incredibly important time for this book to be out, given particularly just thinking of what's going on in the Middle East, where both Gianni and Gabrielle have a huge degree of experience in trying to bring various sides together, getting people to find their way out of the fogs of war and start steering them through the fog of peace. And I wondered on that point, Gabrielle, if I might start by asking, why the fog of peace? Were you decided to write a book? How did you come to this title?
Okay. It looks like people in the room are the generation who would remember Fog of War, which was an iconic documentary by Robert McNamara. In fact, Robert McNamara was the architect of the Vietnam War, in which 3 million Vietnamese were killed and 57,000 Americans. And then he said in his wise old age, when he was no longer in power, the problem was we didn't understand the mind of the enemy. We didn't know who we were fighting. We were fighting different wars. They were fighting the War of Independence. We were fighting the Cold War. So the essence of this book, and in part influenced by this documentary, that in fact Yanni and myself saw together before we even embarked on the book, was the idea that actually we haven't learnt much on that. We are still repeating that. Perhaps unbeknown to ourselves, we enter into conflict through our own Western minds. It's sort of inevitable because it's very, very hard to look into the mind of the other, particularly when they're the enemy and we don't like them. If you think of your own experience, when you don't, if it's a divorcing couple or someone you've had an argument with, the last thing you actually want to do is to empathise or to get into the mind of the other. And let's assume that the more traumatised you are, the actually less inclined you are to actually think what's going on the other side. I mean, the absolute perfect example at the moment is, you know, ISIS, who is so deeply unpalatable to us, but, you know, how far do we want to think who they are, why do they think like this, what is their history, how have they got here? And I think we wanted to say in this book that unless you understand the narrative, both personal and political, both individual, group and state, your ability to resolve conflict is hugely reduced. So we started, Johnny and myself, with this kind of strange mixture or hybrid of myself coming from a psychological background and Gianni coming from a geopolitical background.
From the street.
Yeah, from the streets of Kabul and Beirut. But actually, as the book progressed, I think we reversed roles, didn't we? You were always talking about individual mind, and I would say, come on, let's just work out the geopolitics here. But the essential message is that you have to get into the mind of the other.
Can I just ask you, when did you, because you started out as a background in therapy, except you were a group analyst.
Yes.
When did you first see that this could be something you could translate into the political arena? And particularly, obviously, you had specialised in the
Well, I think it was very organic. I think part of me always wanted to be a politician, but actually was hopeless at committee meetings and all the things you needed to do to become one. I think I was just too much of an iconoclast. The catalytic moment was as a group analyst. I was invited to Israel to go and train 40 group analysts. And this went on, I went with my team and we did it for almost 3 years. And we went 26 times, I think, and it was the height of the Second Intifada. And I just made a decision that if I was going to go and do this, that I felt compelled, maybe because of my training, my background, my work, that I had to understand what was going on both sides. Or maybe that was the only way I could find enough comfort in what I was doing if I some way attempted to do that. But, yeah, we all come, as Yanni will tell you later, with our own partial lenses. And so how much I wanted to do that, I'm sure I could never have managed to do it with complete objectivity.
I was just thinking of yourself. You were working with Pérez Cuellar at the United Nations, then Secretary General, and were an Under Secretary General yourself. You just, in 1988, you achieved something remarkable, brokering the ceasefire between Iran and Iraq in the terrible war between those states. And then having achieved that huge geopolitical landmark, I'm very grateful that you did, but you changed your focus to go to a relatively smaller conflict, but to a tiny part of that conflict, which was the issue of the Western hostages. Myself and we were less than a dozen of us, I think, at that point. What brought you to thinking you could do something there, and why did you want to choose that?
Well, actually, let me first follow what you both just said, because I think is a segue, which is probably useful to understand why I will tell you a few things and not others. And I was very lucky and very unlucky in my human history, in my human journey. I was unlucky, somebody could say, because I'm a son of a small tribe. My tribe has 200,000 people. So we are, by definition, a mini entity. Being for century would be, I hope, for more. And I had a good fortune to have a good father who taught me two commandments. The first one was that the greatest sin under any God is arrogance. And the second commandment he taught me was, never forget to say thank you. The Cold War, which is most part of my life and I think also of yours, was not a political event. To me it was a family event, was a personal event, was almost the hands who shaped who I was for many decades and what I learned. And the reason why I learned things also, I suppose, because I was, I think, 4 years of age when I first saw the Iron Curtain. It was 20 minutes from my house. And that Iron Curtain had actually a peculiarity. First, I realized what it was for the first time when I was 4 years old. And second, because that cemetery was cut by the Iron Curtain into two sides. How idiotic can anybody be than to cut a cemetery into two with everybody dead inside? The Iron Curtain was there. And I began to have a visual imagination of it. And then, of course, what you also remember, because you shaped the world with World War II, that for some, World War II continued much beyond 45. The Soviet army was in Austria until 1955, which meant 20 minutes from my border, from my house. And the British and American troops from north to south, from Klagenfurt to Trieste, until 55. That's where my narrative comes from. And when I had a good fortune of walking the streets of the Levant, I realized how there are things that you cannot be taught. You have to walk the streets to learn. And when it comes to negotiations, let me tell you, I only speak of negotiations because of the negotiation I've done. I've never negotiated with more than one person with me. Most of the time I was alone, no matter if it was a president or anybody else. I don't believe in negotiation by group. I believe those are for television, which is important. Television is an important thing, let's not be too funny about it. I negotiated with a number of countries. I was lucky. I negotiated with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and Cyprus. I failed with Cyprus. They are unbeatable. They are too big for me. And what I learned was also because I really took a very close to my heart another motto that one of my boss told me, and that was, if you succeed, we all win. If you lose, you go in front of the public opinion and say it's your fault. And that is what I did. Now, well, to me, therefore, the question of this adventures of negotiations really is an adventure from the east to the west, not from the west to the east. I remember, and I was sorry of thinking about that, when Terry Wade was caught in Beirut, I was sorry for him. But my comment was, why would you go to Lebanon from the west? You go from the east, isn't it? That's the way I thought it would work. And it did work, except that there were things I could not imagine. The case of the Western hostages in Lebanon is only one of the cases I had a good fortune of helping out. And it was a case where, well, maybe you cannot call it a negotiation. I come down to the point that you made earlier. The end of the Iran-Iraq war, which my boss and myself had the privilege of saying before history in the world, we actually did it in ourselves, when the New York Times had come out the day before saying negotiations are broken, the Iraqi government has refused, everybody's gone home. The following Monday at 12 o'clock New York Times, the war was over. The curiosity of that negotiation, to give a sense of how I'm not speaking about negotiation that you read in the newspaper, is that neither Iraq nor Iran were present. We did not need them. Because that war was ended by speaking and convincing the bankers of Saddam to stop paying. And that's what happened. The war was ended by negotiations which were done with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the highest level, my boss and myself. And they were ended on that basis. Iraq was not present. Iran was not present. They were told within a few hours, or even less, and they said, thank you very much. Saddam did not like me for that and tried a couple of times to kill me in there, but that was things that you know well. History is full of irrelevant personal references. But I began to learn that negotiation is every time different. Whenever anybody tells you, how do you negotiate with Iran, you know that it's never done it. You don't negotiate with the country. You only negotiate with people. And if you say that you negotiate with the country, thank you very much, let's go and have a pizza, because there's nothing to discuss. And the reason is very simple. That every moment of our lives is different, and every moment of a country life is different. If you negotiate with President Rafsanjani, you have got to be a very good merchant. And this is, may seem a banal. Why was he a merchant mentality? Did anybody of you remember Rafsanjani? Of course, was many years ago. He was an Ayatollah without beard. And I asked myself, why does he not have one? Well, it's very simple. He was of Mongol descent, and the Mongol ethnicity does not have much facial hair. Nothing special. So, but he was a bit, how does he feel being Ayatollah and not having a beard? Well, he had already replied to the question. He became rich. Very rich. Extremely rich. So he was dealing like a merchant. And we negotiated like a merchant. But if you have negotiated with Khatami, which I did, let me tell you, if you did not know about Hegel and Descartes, Locke and Hume, you would be in trouble. Because Khatami is a philosopher, much better than any I had known, and he uses images of philosophers, of their respective philosophy. And that was a different way of negotiating.
That's interesting. So this was getting to know the characters of the people you were dealing with rather
Absolutely.
Than the politics.
And yes.
One was the merchant, the man, both very powerful
yes.
characters, obviously,
yes.
one a philosopher.
Yes.
And how did you, I mean, when you go to meet these people first off, you have briefed yourself, you know the situation as well as you can. Is there a way in, I'll ask you in a moment, Gabriel, as to thinking, how am I going to progress with this man or this woman, whoever I'm speaking with?
Well, first, you know, you try to read as much as you can about the person. You know, when you go meet somebody, try to understand who he is, or try to read as much as you can. You know, the present leader of Iran will never forgive himself because he didn't go to Oxford and you know, or Cambridge. In his own world, he did not. In Oxford or Cambridge, in his world, was other two universities where he did not go.
Ask it.
There we go. You see? Imagine. He went to Mashhad. Mashhad. What is Mashhad? You know, he did not go to Qom. So, he has all these things. And if you look a little bit about Khamenei, you will see that that was a problem for him. Now, big problem, little problem, that varies. But it's an individual, you know? It's not a question, how do you negotiate with the Shia population? Oh, please. The Shia population is so, you know, hundreds of millions. Everybody is different, you know. For instance, just because I carry an Italian name, you don't think that I'm Italian, do you? No, because if you do, I walk out, you know. So the negotiation that I was given to try were literally from the street on. I never went to Lebanon from the west, always from the east. Pakistan, Iran, things you learn in the streets are amazing. And also, it tells you much that you could never read in the books. And so the question of ending a war without the combatants would never cross the mind of a Westerner, I think. Well, it did, actually, cross mine. And I'm still Westerner, despite my, dubious past. But that was exactly what the negotiation that Gabriel was referring to is all about. That is important. Otherwise, you do nothing. You don't even scratch the surface. Let me just tell you something a bit provocative. Many of you, I'm sure, in November of last year would have heard of this negotiation of the 5+1 with Iran and an agreement reached in Geneva. But with the 5+1, you know where they are, met with Iran and had a first step in the process. Of course, it was not done in Geneva. And not by 5+1. The negotiation of 5+1 was done by two countries, as it should be, one-to-one, finished in a different continent, sent by computer to Geneva, and then the picture was taken, the 5+1 made an agreement. It's not that it's wrong. That's what it is. And if you believe that you can negotiate with 5 delegations plus 1 of 5 persons of 6 each, you don't know what negotiations are. Never was. That's not it. That's not it. So when I went to Beirut to find our good friend and 12 of his compatriots from other countries, and I had done my negotiation with Iran, I got to Beirut and they said, Mr. P, there will be an inconvenience. So what's the inconvenience? I've done the negotiation with the boss who commands Hezbollah, which is a Shia group that has taken everybody. What else do I have to do? And they said, actually, there is an inconvenience. They want to talk to you. Excuse me? Which meant I had to be taken hostage, which I was 4 times, blindfolded, locked in a car, taken away during the night, I disappear from the earth. And I negotiated under machine guns and with not many clothes, not like this. It was a little bit more skimpy. And the negotiation taught me immediately something incredible. And that the greatest terrorist of Hezbollah, only 10 million on his head by the U.S. government, and mask, of course. He was masked. I was not even dressed, to be correct. And he said to me, do you think I do not know that taking innocent people from the streets is the best thing to do? Because if you don't think that I know that, and this is another addition, you are insulting my mother. He said, I didn't say your mother anything. He said, no, because the implication would be that my mother has not taught me the right thing to live. Now, would you imagine that one of the leaders of Hezbollah thinks in this way? No. And the reason is because you're lucky, you didn't have to negotiate with them. And that was the beginning of the way that, the second country, I had adventures in 4 different countries and took home more than 100 people in different countries, and you were the second group.
Yeah.
And they were all different. But the point is, the man in front of me was an individual with all his sins, well, I had a few sins also, and everything else, and nothing that can be taught by any institution, by any university of Harvard or Cambridge or Oxford, forgive me. This is the question is, why are you have to make a decision. Do I allow myself to be blindfolded and taken away at night in Beirut and maybe never to come back? But then I had my father teaching, and so I remember. And what I remember was, remember never to forget to say thank you. So I allow myself to be taken away with no chance to know if I will come back. Because I had to say thank you first and foremost to the countries who helped my big boy, today 37, to be alive today. And those countries are not called Italy or the others. And that's why I allow myself. That was the decision I took in the dark, in Beirut, and I said, take me, we go. If you don't say thank you, what life is it? So you see, that's why there was a little bit of a difference from the theory of negotiation of, others.
But that's fascinating, because you're bringing your personal story, and I can say thank you again in front of these nice people, that you took that extraordinary risk. And what you're saying about the leader of the actual group of kidnappers that you met and how strange that response was about you're insulting my mother, it's fascinating, and weird things happen. I do remember
one of the guards, one of the junior members of the group, Islamic Jihad, once asking me to teach him to disco dance, which we never got round to doing. But we can be, I think it's fascinating, this idea that Johnny is talking there about taking an extraordinary personal risk to proceed with that wonderful project. But you've taken risks too. And I wonder if there's the point of, we're taking emotional risks, but as well as potentially physical risks, and how you present yourself to someone as, probably you'll shoot me down, I'm sure, for using the phrase, but to be an honest broker, someone who they can talk to and will trust that you can listen.
Yeah. I suppose you're referring to the chapter in the book where Gianni talks about his experience, it's called The So-Called Diplomat, and mine's called The Therapist Story. And in that chapter, what I describe is some of my meetings with the leadership of Hamas. And in fact, in practice, what happened is we would go in cars where it's blacked out, and we actually wouldn't know where we were going. And so at one level, you could think about was there a personal risk involved. But actually, well, there were key things. First of all, we went with a trusted intermediary, and that was very important. And I suppose at that moment, the kind of assessment about who you trust and don't trust is the absolute key piece of it. Who is a safe pair of hands? And strangely enough, it doesn't feel like a risk in that context because, and I think this is what linked Gianni and myself together, was we originally met in Tehran. And it's, we come from...
I'm sorry, well, usually a good Jewish girl meets a good Catholic boy, right? That's obvious. I hope you got the point.
Coming from extraordinarily different backgrounds. But the essence was, and why, you know, you could think just different analysis of the world. And I actually just, I remember the very first encounter, we'd come up with this kind of completely harebrained idea of trying to get the president of Israel to sit with the president or the ex-president of Iran because they came from the same small town in Shad. And in fact, it was Hatami, and then it was the ex-president of Israel who actually in the end was up on charges, sexual charges, so that would not be an effective However, I remember showing the idea to Gianni and saying, what do you think about this? And sort of feeling a little nervous. And of course you said something like, interesting. And of course because I think you liked the lateral nature of it, the fact that it was coming from a completely different position, the idea at that moment was if we could get them to sit very quietly together off the record, instead of these kind of projections about being the enemy, was there a chance that the act of humanising the process possibly could have started something off the record? In fact, it couldn't get anywhere, not least because when Ahmadinejad Jab was voted in, and there are moments in history when things are possible. But I suppose the essence of it, and where we completely cemented our thinking, was that we actually believe that beyond all the real politics, beyond all the power relationships, there are still people, ordinary human beings with motivations who are clearly restricted by the bureaucracy or the geopolitics, but nevertheless, if you can build some kind of relationship in which you are seen to be trustworthy or credible, and my skill, I mean, I'm not negotiating at the level that Gianni did, What I can do is I have to build trust with the right cast of characters I'm trying to bring together. And they have to think so, and in fact I don't only work with the individual, sometimes my base trade is group analysts, so I will sometimes bring together groups of people who will work quietly off the radar, groups who perhaps in the official process would not have had the chance to sit together, who will see things very differently, but we would create a safe space for a period of time, maybe for 2-3 days or longer, where, in fact, it provided an opportunity to understand each other's red lines, where the areas were of possibly radical disagreement. But it comes from the position that if you create the right conditions, there are sometimes opportunities where people can find work, what they're, if they do have common agendas. So I think that the essence which actually drives this book is that in the context of real politics, which is about interests and land and power and territory, there are still meeting the bits.
And as you're working through a process of a group, a series of meetings, perhaps, developing a relationship with people, given that you play and you obviously are working in the world of real politics, do you get the feedback of their concerns about, well, we've got to go back to our constituency, to our institution, or is it, we can't go back with them? We may be building relationships here and moving our thinking forward.
Absolutely. You know, you have to be incredibly vigilant, and you don't want to get seduced by just what happens in the room, because people do have constituencies, and they need to go home, and they need to reflect what people are ready for, and are they seen to be betraying their people. So you have to, in any kind of understanding, you have to understand the bigger picture. And in fact, when you sit with someone like Khalid Nishal, who's the leader of Hamas, they will, in fact, they are entirely driven through where the people are on the ground and what they feel that they will accept. And unless you have a way of attuning to that, which, I mean, in some ways, to a Western lens, can seem extremely frustrating, because you're thinking, where's the leadership? Where's the vision? Where's the vision to lead people forward in terms of any conflict? So just to give an example, in one of our meetings, we actually talked about, the question I asked him was about the Hamas Charter, which some of you will know is a very toxic document that talks about the Jewish conspiracy and... and if you talk to Israelis, they will say, how can we start engaging with Hamas when there's this charter? So when you talk to Khalid Nishal, who probably a part of him would want to change this charter, and we'd already done some kind of consultation with people on the ground who said, why don't we suspend it? This is the Palestinians. They're kind of ashamed of the language of it. But he knew that there were so many internal differences within the organisation that he wasn't going to say what we wanted to hear, and we had to understand the politics of whose constituency was, and often that things moved very, very slowly. And hence the importance of, if you have the opportunity, of having a kind of sustained and long-term relationship, because actually one of the things maybe it's a generalisation, and you both might not fully describe it like this, but governments are always looking for rational agendas. Have people change their mind? Are they ready for negotiation? But often people who have been involved in endless conflict are very traumatised and are actually not in a state of mind or a state of readiness actually to be able to negotiate. So where the psychology or the kind of our understanding is very important is you sort of have to start at where people's states of mind are. I just want to just read one fantastic quote on that. There's a book, let's see if I can find it. There's a book called by somebody written by Dr. Abolish, I Will Not Hate. I don't know if you remember at the last, not the last Gaza War, the Gaza War before, in fact, he's got 9 children and 3 of them were killed in. And he, partly because he had worked in Israeli hospitals and because the relationship had been humanized and that he didn't just see Palestinians and Israelis, he saw human beings and he'd worked together on medical projects. And he says, let's see if I can find that he says, you cannot think that an unhealthy person thinks logically. Everyone has psychiatric problems one way or the other. And of course, when you think about asymmetrical war, or where you've got
on one side the state, and then you've got non-state actors on the other side. The non-state actors are often the ones without the kind of weapons and the military as we know it, and therefore they use methods of war that people find very difficult and very, very repugnant. But often the non-state actors have had many members of their own family killed. So, for example, in Gaza, many people have lost members of their families, brothers and sisters, and these are often the leadership. Whereas in governments, often they are more distant from war. They are making decisions without actually having that same level of suffering. And so you have to understand often more, I'm not sure I can quite parallel Palestine Israel, because both sides have their own histories of trauma, which deeply influence and shape the conflict. And in that conflict, it's not really about the actual bones of what a deal will be. It's much more about what is the state of mind, and are people in a state of readiness in which they actually don't see the other side as an existential threat who wants to wipe them out, but more some kind of idea can they live with them. And until you get to a state of mind where you believe that you can live with the other, it doesn't really matter too much about the property.
In the book, you make the point, particularly when conflict breaks out, it becomes much harder for people. Those divisions, those separate positions will become very much reinforced. That sense of the existential threat will be highlighted. And therefore, it's very much harder to then say, okay, let's draw back from the guns and the battlefields or the suicide bombers or whatever it may be. How do you talk in the book about ways, a new way of thinking. Obviously you're promoting. How can we get to the point? Syria has gone completely crazy, of course, and Iraq is once again being caught up in all of that. What, in your view, how should we set up, could a system be set up that would allow those stories from both sides or many sides to be understood by the other, so that it isn't these walls, these divisions can come so stark, so rapidly?
Well, I think for this question I have to make a phone call upstairs to ask what to say. let me add one practical element to what has been said so far, which I agree with. Negotiating during the Cold War was much easier. After the Cold War, it became a mess. And the reason was, in my experience, I'll tell you what I've done. During the Cold War, we had two or three variables. And if there was something problematic, you call your cousins in Washington and somebody goes to Moscow and you sort it out. And everybody else falls into line. The Cold War had its advantages. There was, a hierarchical order. And so that, when the Cold War collapses, the number of variables in a negotiation skyrockets. Which also explains why, after the end of the Cold War, 1992, to this day, multilateralism, and specifically the United Nations, had never resolved one conflict because they were built for the Cold War. But if you don't look into this and go a bit deeper to see how it makes a difference, you continue doing nothing. All the conflict from Bosnia on in the last 20 years had always been done by television minilateralism and in reality bilateralism. Television, 5+1, before. Those things, for the balance. But it's good for publicity because, you don't have to explain too much. And you don't appear to have one or two doing. This is the change historical. The difficulty is also that institutions that we have today, in many parts of the world, have a problem, like we have a problem, individuals, to understand that history moves on. And tomorrow is a new day and a new page. And you can't do in 2017 what you did in 1947. It's out of the world. The plate doesn't work. It's a different world, different people, different everything. But institutions are anchored to what they know, and therefore they do nothing. I'm talking about conflict resolution. I don't speak in detail. I've never, never done a negotiation in my life where somebody was telling me what to do and what rules they were. No. If I fail, and when I failed, which I did fail, I went public and I said, mea culpa, it's my fault, the organization was perfect, it's my fault. And when I made a mistake, I never touched the subject again. In fact, all the documents were taken away from me. That was the rule I worked on. You fail, there's no going back, because in life you don't go back. And so, when the Cold War ended, it was so complicated, because everybody wanted to be king of the real. You know, anyone. And Libya wants to do this, and whatever. Yemen wants to do that. You know, it kind of kids without a teacher. Now, I know it's a rough one to say. I don't say that I envy the Cold War, and I want to go back, because it's not true. But it requires a different way of negotiating. And fundamentally, it's no longer an institutional negotiation. Absolutely, forget about that. They don't work. You know, there has to be a different analysis of what the situation. I received, thanks God, you know, maybe people are kind to me. I received calls to help in conflict resolution long after I left the UN by prime ministers and others. Why? Because they knew that I would never follow the rules. Because if you want to work, you know, the rules are written for yesterday. Because you cannot rule what you don't know yet. What you don't know yet is you have to go into a different level, in my view, of how to negotiate in the world which is new today. You know, this is special. I'm talking about the Levant, but there were, you know, it is individuals who make history. I can tell you a very brief thing. You know, you may remember that there was a story in Afghanistan of the Soviet Union invading the country in 1980. And I think was the first Westerner to enter Kabul after the Soviets. Not because they were my friends, but and what happened in Kabul was that the chaos, the war and whatever, nobody expected to finish early. Well, let me tell you, it could have, and I'll give you now name and in date. You may remember that the leaders of the Soviet Union were God for the Soviet Union. At some point after Brezhnev went down, there was a man called Andropov. Andropov became the leader of the Soviet Union. He had been the leader of the KGB for 15 years. It was the end of November, December 82. In January 83, the leader of the Soviet Union sent to me and to my colleague a messenger that doesn't come from the Soviet embassy or any place, meets us in a place that he would not even expect, and comes to us and says, Andropov wants to leave Afghanistan because it was a mistake. January 83. This is not written in any history book. And for 6 months, we negotiated secretly without even the Afghans, which are not really important. And what happened? 5 months later, end of May, the envoy that really almost impossible for a Soviet diplomat would operate alone, never happened, as you know. We all know that, right? In early June of 83, he dies. And by end of June, beginning of July, as you know probably very well, Andropov disappears from the political scene because he gets sick and dies 7 months later. And the war in Afghanistan continued for another 5 years. One man would have done that, and it was ready. Not with the institution, not with the KGB, not with it. He had taken the responsibility himself, but unfortunately died. And the war continued. And so we had to wait Gorbachev to come in, and Gorbachev said, in a meeting of three people, and I was across one of those three people, he said, "Pico, we don't end the war in Afghanistan because you tell us to do." I said, "Well, I'm glad." And he said, "I'm going to end the war in Afghanistan because the Soviet mothers told me they don't want to see body bags again." And that's how Gorbachev became a maker of history. That's what he said. And from that moment on, everything else was a kid's game. Gorbachev said, "The Soviet mothers do not want to see dead bodies again. We are going out of Afghanistan." 3 years before the war. Because he had that, so sometimes you're lucky, you get individuals like this, and then you don't have to do anything. You just have to ride the wave with the history makers, like Gorbachev, you know. If you don't, you take your risk and you go where you can go, you know. And, you know, I negotiated with the Israeli intelligence during the operation in Lebanon, and they were magnificent negotiations. You know, for the first time next month, I will go probably to some place to Israel with my real name, which would be a satisfaction. But I mean, they were magnificent people in every place who had the courage of doing what needed to be done, not to follow an institution, not to follow the instructions on a piece of paper, but to take the responsibility and say, if I win, I win, and if I lose, I will declare I've lost, and I go. And this is what, you encounter these people everywhere. They're not just in one country, they're everywhere. But institutions make it very difficult to find them. You know, one of them, my teachers told me when I was young, do you want to make history or do you want a pension? It was not a joke. It was not a joke. And he was right.
I mean, that point, as you say, if you can find someone with courage or someone who can think outside the box and give an institutional perhaps government has put he or she in, that is remarkable. And then you can, as you say, be sitting there riding the wave with the history makers and being part of that process. But I imagine there's an awful lot of resistance. Governments, institutions have their ways of doing things. Do they welcome the private work that you might be doing, for instance, Gabrielle? Or is it, look, we can't take too much notice of you, we'll keep going up with the big public statements and the national interest?
It's a very good question, because there would be no point in doing what we did unless we had some links or doors open to government. It would be actually a very futile exercise of raising people's expectations where you couldn't do anything with it. So what I always try and do is any group I create that it actually has access to the political process. And in fact, the work we did on Iran, we did a lot of work on the Iranian nuclear issue, on what a deal would look like. And we did this 2 years ago, Chinese and more. But we got people in the room who could go and open the doors so the work we did, we could go and go and see the appropriate foreign ministers. And it was before the Rouhani government was voted into power, so the mood was very suspicious, and of course it's always about timing. And so you can do stuff in advance, and then sometimes things move to create the right conditions. But we went to see the British government at a very senior level, and we know that after our meetings that they said, because we had the Iranians as part of our in-round, small round tables, and that we had not only shaped it around interests, we actually said, what are all the different red lines that these other countries, and what can people live with? And then we presented, and the British government had to say, well, we're not actually presenting enough. Or the Americans, you know, the kind of conditions that were being imposed was actually making, at that point, impossible. So groups like us perhaps had some kind of input in terms of shifting the dialogue, but, it doesn't always go that way. The nature of, in fact, Jenny and myself worked on trying to open some doors on Iran for several years, but the mood, you having had such very high-level contacts, but then under the Ahmadinejad government, people became very nervous, and you had to be very careful. People got arrested if they were involved in these roundtables, and they were in prison, so you had to be very, very sensitive as to what was possible. So how are we viewed? I think we're viewed with mixed feelings. It's by governments, because governments often think, well, this is our job, and yet they also recognise that there's a certain unofficial process that can actually support the official process. And certainly what we would always say is we're there always to support whether there could be an official way through.
Yeah, indeed, to follow that, what you just said, there are occasions in our experience where, in fact, governments called out and said, do something, because we can't. To summarize in a very, poor way, like, a foreigner like me can do. But it has happened. They called and said, we can't do it. Can you help us? I said, you must be joking. I'm talking about that to governments here who call me, in my little house in Connecticut and say, we are sending somebody to see you tomorrow, and, we spoke with the Americans because you live in America. Well, fine. And I said, are you kidding? And here, this person admitted openly, I cannot communicate with the head of government of that country, and I have my people there, prisoners. Can you help me? And, that was a lucky shot, though. I did it, but it was lucky. I don't claim that it was a great operation, but it did. 16 people came home in a few days. And the government could not contact the head of government of the other country. But, you know, sometimes life is so funny or so complicated. And so these things happen in a way which is not so unpredictable, but one has to be realistic about what you can do and what you cannot do, you know. When a government like Iran wants to, is very upset with the American government, they just call me and they say, please, tell the puppeteer, which is the British, to tell the puppets, the Americans, to stop. Because in the Iranian mentality, many still believe that you're in charge of Washington. You should be very happy. No, I'm serious, I'm just a joke. Real words. Please tell the puppeteers to stop the puppets. This was not many years ago, so, you know, I always said this is the greatest country in the world.
I mean, that point is fascinating because you think, amazing, they think we're running Washington. Wonderful.
Yes.
But to know that, and that was, as you say, a very high-level Iranian connection.
Very much.
In terms of trying to move things forward and thinking about, I mean, the horrors of what's going on in the Middle East, particularly at the moment, you write, both of you, about the idea of having a team of mediators who will be local, not perhaps people flying in the Westerns to Iran or to Israel, Palestine, or whatever. Is that an idea? As you say, top people might decide to call you in Connecticut at a moment when they have a crisis. But is there an understanding or a view, yes, we should be better briefed on these things. When we're making decisions, whether it's committing British troops, as we have done in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. Do you think that there is a willingness, or is it the modern system of politics is too short-term for people to say, yes, all right, that's a good idea, we must build these, not networks of people, but teams of mediators, some who might rove or some who might be based in particular regions?
Well, I mean, I think it links with Freud Museum, this one, that Freud recognised the potential destruction to the nature of human beings. But one thing we say in our book is that there are people potentially can be aggressive and destructive, and they can also be benign and cooperative, and it depends on the conditions you create. Now, if you look at something like the war in Syria, where actually there was not sectarian violence. Maybe it was held, the lid was held on by a very oppressive authoritarian government. But nevertheless, in some way, people were living together. And one of the things about conflict, as soon as war begins, it unleashes the most destructive aspects of human behaviour. Actually, what happens is when war goes on long enough, what we really want is retribution. We want the other side to suffer more than us. And so what we've made a plea for in this book is the idea of early intervention, where we've talked about, we've actually used the word commander team of mediators, but what we're really pushing it further is to say, if there was embedded systems of mediation, if instead of the billions we spend on the industrial military complex and the arms race, etc., that we just put a fraction of this into proper systems of mediation, early warning, having people on the ground. Now, you'd have to be very sensitive. You don't necessarily just want Westerners flying in to solve all the problems. You want to work on the ground with local communities so that you might use the local tribal leader or doctor or whatever to work at that level. And then maybe at a government level, maybe you'd have, you know, someone like Gianni and his team who had already been there and had a relationship with the SAC. They may or may not have listened, or, you know, he might want to only listen to his family, but nevertheless, you'd still have systems of embedded mediators there, and then you'd also have people operating at the international level. So the war in Syria, which we sort of write about in the book, is a proxy war. And the prime players who have fueled this war are Saudi Arabia and Iran. So if we had immediately systems, whether it's round tables or mediation, much, much earlier on is our point. Now, of course it wouldn't always work, but our experience tells us all this stuff is too partial, peripheral, too late.
If you may just follow what you just said,
yeah.
I think Gabriel and I wrote a piece 3 years ago where we begged, please stop calling this a Syrian civil war. It is not a Syrian civil war, and we also added it will not be resolved in Syria because this covers, at that time we said, the Syrian-Iraqi space. And the reason is that, of course, the Levant has been, you know, has been is a remnant of agreements reached in 1916 by Sykes-Picot, any sign that there is another Pico without a T at the end, which is a new agreement. No, but I mean, that one, and of course, Gertrude Bell, probably the woman I love most in history. I hope you all know she was so small, but she was magnificent. She spoke 18 dialects of Arabic, she knew everything about that, and she invented, as you know, to salvage the promise given by Lawrence to Faisal, she invented Iraq. The Iraq of 1920 was invented by the magnificent teeny Gertrude Bell, a magnificent individual who knew everything about Islam and the Arab world in a way that I don't know how many after have learned. And I think she invented Iraq. Churchill asked her because the promise had to be maintained. And so she said, and as Churchill said, you were not because you're too young, but when he said, if it's good for Gertrude, it's good for me. And I said, it's good for me too. But what I think what Gabriel is saying is, you know, it's what she's almost saying, but not saying, is that unfortunately it's very difficult. History is moving on. Governments are handling with the reality which is beyond their means. We have a global economy. We have a technology which has empowered individuals in a level that the nation state never did imagine. And so the whole landscape has changed. And we still have tools which belong to another time of our history. And I'm not saying that anybody of us has a solution, but I can tell you that as long as you continue to operate on the basis of institutions that pursue their pension and not making history, it may be difficult. And that's what has happened. You know, I always define myself a child of a lesser God because I am. But as my father would add, he said, but considering what children of major God have been doing for centuries, don't be too sad, my boy. but we are just nothing. We are a small group of nothing. But, you know, we had to survive. We survive and we keep our dignity and we have learned a few things and that humanity has killed each other under false pretenses for too long. And time is, to use also as to, in diplomacy or moral, I don't even like the word diplomacy because it's too almost banal. We have to use other abilities in our courages and not to just, the definition that we are courageous when we kill somebody is almost despicable. You are courageous when you build things, not when you destroy. That's what they told me, but I come from a little people of 20,000. So I'm not that important. But when everything will be said and done, I will not leave any money to my children, but I will leave the life of 127 human beings, I say from four different countries, the majority of which were from the Muslim faith. That's what I will leave as an inheritance. And when somebody comes and talks to me and convinces me that they've done more or better, I will listen. Until the time, my family's had enough sufferance and enough difficulties from Auschwitz to the Stalag of the Soviet Union. I don't think I need anybody else to tell me anything else. I've gone enough. And I was very lucky because apart from those lives, I brought home also some dead bodies. And I will never forget at Andrew Air Force Base when I brought back a body of an American colonel. And the whole ceremony stopped and his wife went to the plane which was opening to bring down the coffin. And she asked me from afar without a word to go, and I crossed this enormous amount of territory, so to speak, in the airport. And there was nobody else around. She had asked everybody to leave and they were far away, 100 yards or so. And the body of this colonel came down. I had recovered him 3 months earlier. And she looked at me. She said, thank you. And that was it. That is what life is all about. Any idiot can kill, but only a great soul can say thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. At that point, I've been asking all the questions. And we have a little time left, obviously, with our session. I'm sure you've all been listening with enormous interest to Gabriel and Johnny, and you've probably been thinking questions that you too would like to ask them. So please, Daniel, somewhere has a microphone. Lady here in the front there.
I just forgot what your father's first piece of advice was.
Piece of advice is arrogance is the worst of sins, is the only sin in his life. Arrogance is the greatest sin of humanity. But you know, we only want to be Mighty Mouse. It's the weakest complex of humanity, Mighty Mouse.
Apparently Kordakovsky said recently that Putin only understands forms, and I wonder what you think the lessons he learned from this part of the world.
I don't know. it's interesting. The Putin case to me is very curious, because when the whole thing started, at least in the explosion in Ukraine, I took the presumption of saying that there was only one person who could really talk positively, constructively with him, and that was Angela Merkel. At the time, people laughed at me. But I think even now something is that she's the only, in my view, the only interlocutor he can talk to. First of all, he speaks German, she speaks Russian perfectly, which is a lot. And second, going back to the narrative that Gabriel mentioned earlier at the beginning of this thing, I mean, I think that there are many people here who know what the Russian narrative is with regard to Europe and Germans and whatever. And there is no question, despite everything that happened, there is in the narrative of Russia, there is a degree of respect and admiration for the Germans, which it does not exist for anybody else in the world. Right, wrong, that is irrelevant. That's what they, and you know, and if you see when they, in the few occasions when they are together in public with other head of states, you may have noticed that they always have a little chat together, even in between, you know, when it was a commemoration of D-Day and all the rest. Those things are important because they communicate easily. They don't need to have, you know, translation or all the rest. And I think that she can still contribute and to do something that nobody else can do for what you say, for almost structural reasons. You know, and so maybe she will do. I do not know. I do not know. You know, I can't help, you know, as you said. They have three volumes of me in Soviet Union or Russia. I don't think they need to know anything else.
I just wanted to ask about your ideas of setting up a kind of local negotiation in pre-events. How might that work with climate change, which is something that is so dismal, quite behind?
That's a challenging question. I want to put it back to you, because I bet you've got a few thoughts on this. Do you want to say something to begin with?
No, but I was just wondering about how you could negotiate between, I guess, corporations mm-hmm. and minorities who are being affected, at least now, before it affects the West. How you give a voice to those people, how you become a negotiator for those, and with the corporations, we assume it would be a much easier task if their institutions themselves with people being affected. So how we can begin to kind of deal with that through negotiation before the major conflicts.
I mean, it's very interesting what you're talking about, because often the negotiations break down because the competing narratives are not understood. And China has all kinds of domestic issues that they have to deal with. And that when the negotiations break down, was it in Copenhagen? About 3 or 4 years ago. It seemed to be, one of the problems was that all the competing narratives were not sufficiently factored in to prepare behind the scenes. And so your question is, what kind of preparatory work needs to be done? Well, you don't. Well, what often happens in, say, even environmental groups is people get together with people who think like them. And actually what you need to do is create spaces or round tables where you actually have different competing narratives and where within that are the common interests. I mean, I don't think it'd be beyond us to try and evolve structures to think about that. But it's what you do in preparation which actually matters, and maybe that's where not enough thought is given.
You used a word once about commandos.
Commando teams.
Yeah, commando team. Yeah. Not to destroy something, but to build something.
But the importance is what you do behind the scenes quietly in preparation and investing in that. Seriously.
have the question?
Yeah, I was thinking about your mediation commandos as well. But I was wondering how, I mean, so many countries who need such specialized mediation commandos. I'm thinking about Nigeria and how you deal with Boko Haram and things like that. And then the trouble is that they will become institutionalized themselves within each embedment.
In fact, that's what Johnny, when we were being in conversation, he'd say, watch out, you'll just get another bureaucracy.
Yep.
So of course you do have to watch out. Yep. And one of the words we kept using in the book was, how do you create new, maybe institutions isn't the right word, but new agile groups that can be responsive and flexible and have systems of early warning. And that it doesn't immediately get bogged down by bureaucracies. But of course you're right, that each conflict is completely different and you need very, very specialist groups. But it wouldn't be beyond our imagination to have specialist groups in conflict resolution who are attached to governments or maybe attached to the UN in some way. Johnny and myself went through Johnny's connections to the number two person at the UN, somebody called Jan Eliasson, to sort of try and explore this idea further. And they said, well, of course we do this. But of course they do it in such a marginal, peripheral way. And in fact, you know, these things are very complicated. He did give the example when you've got the big powers involved. One of the problems with Syria is the fact that you've got Russia and America who are so actively in conflict with each other about their different interests, and he said, you know, Yemen's easier. We could get a national dialogue going because Russia and America are not thinking about it. And there are real, real challenges about how we could devise a system like this. And we actually in the book talked about, could it be something a bit like the International Criminal Court? But I think the point we were trying to make is not because we wanted another institution, but it needs to be something really serious with proper resources put in that it becomes embedded and not a little add-on when it's too late.
One person in the front, further back, then we'll ask.
Thank you, that was really interesting and I could ask so much. I'm wondering about the pattern. There was a revealing exchange on the way here where I was chatting to somebody and that along the road. Oh, sorry, which crisis were you talking about? I come from public health and I thought Ebola was the existential crisis. What about the pattern? We lost the ability to feel for others.
To feel for others?
Yes, to feel for others. Conflict.
This is for you.
You
think? Yes, she receives tomorrow at 10 o'clock for the session.
Yeah, to address anything. As I should mention, I've been dabbling in social psychology representations and also the intricate detail of dialogue.
Are you talking about sort of conflict fatigue? There's too many conflicts to think about, it's too overwhelming in practice, most people don't spend more than 2 minutes a day thinking about it. You could easily think the war in Syria wasn't going on anymore because the media is not focusing on it, is not thinking about it. And actually, there's a little bit in the book where I think I'm trying to address this idea that it's just too big for us to think about. And how I say something like, as a child, I like to think that people in conflict were different to me. They didn't have the same level of emotion and they weren't suffering in the same way. And it was because I didn't know how to think about it and I couldn't bear to think about it. And I think what you're kind of identifying is it's such a problem because governments only go where public opinion goes. And you know, because we're all tired on Syria, we have no policy on Syria. We have no political policy, either coming from the US or the UN or whatever, beyond how we deal with ISIS. Anyhow, over to you.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, you know, I spent a lot of decades about in the area that I mentioned to you, from Pakistan to Cyprus. By the way, as I said at the beginning, the only my great failure negotiation was with Cyprus. But then I consoled myself and yes, of course, by the British. So of course I could, because the British taught them what to say, and of course I could not succeed with them. In parenthesis, my greatest failure on Cyprus was in 1983, and when I failed, true to the commitment I'd taken with my superior, I went public saying it was my fault, and within 24 hours, an officer of the, which I never met before in my life, came to my office and took away every single tidbit of papers about the Cyprus question for 10 years before that moment. I failed, and therefore I paid. And that's what happened. If the bureaucracy was to work in that way, it would be much faster, you know, and to move on. And I never touched again. And I thought I put it off. I had made a deal with the last general president of Turkey in 1983. I said, I got it. Done, you're right. Fine, finish. So I told my boss he should bring the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots together on this thing. And they came, and one said to me, Pico, the man who will make me sign an agreement of Cyprus is not born yet. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, that's what he said, on the record. And the other one said, wow, this is a very poor result, Pico. Well, I think that who said that today is dreaming about going back to the possibility of 1983. But that doesn't really matter. I failed. So that's the only thing that is so great. All these things are nothing, you know? And I thought I was in top of the world. I made it an agreement on the solution of that problem with the general president of Turkey, who could have done everything, you know, in that world, anything he wanted. He was, you know, the king.
But no. Actually, I read that book, that bit again in the book, and what you said is that they didn't want something imposed.
Well, yes.
Emerge from them.
Yeah.
I don't know how true that is. I mean,
it is true, but of course it is based on the fact that the question of you impose something is predicated on two approaches. One, that there is a middle of the road, which never is, never exists. This is just a fantasy. And second, that this was imposed. Yes, definitely, you can do that, because if you put on the table that a number of people are dying every day or every year in this particular crisis, and you think that that is a great triumph because you killed them, well, you know, go to the other world. I mean, this is not the world where I want my children to live. You know, and that's basically the story of how you see. See, when somebody comes and says to me, you know, but we have killed so many, I said, I'm sorry, we live in different worlds. I will not leave to my children the death of anybody by their father. I will not. And that is fundamental point. Unless they come and try to shoot me, I will not do that, because that is not the way. See, we cannot continue to live in the past. This is the past history, you know? This is the past history.
I don't know. Right, yeah. I think you were talking about human behaviour.
Yeah.
And how far human behaviour.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
And taking
sure.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
But you know, I kind of want to ask John. Scott Katz. John, you're the one, you know, as a journalist, who must constantly think about this idea of our fatigue to engage with conflict and the political consequences of that.
Well, I was just thinking, it was intriguing having co-authored a couple of books myself, how you two got on, presumably in England and Connecticut, swapping chapters, and whether that's peaceful and amicable, the process, as hopefully some of your negotiations have been worked. Yeah, well, in a moment, but I'll answer your question. But I think that's a very good point. I made a radio program earlier this year for Radio 4 about Kurdistan, particularly looking at Iraqi Kurdistan, the region that has been self-autonomous for some years now, and it was fascinating because the atmosphere then, just a few months ago, was incredibly positive. Yes, there were still big rivalries between the main political groups, but they were working on it, and it seemed that they were sincerely working on it, and that they were confident that perhaps they weren't going to go for independence completely from Iraq, but that they were confident they could maintain a place. talked about the end of the nation state, that they didn't have to have a nation state. They had to have perhaps a central area, which would be the Iraqi bit of Kurdistan, where they would feel safe, they could be Kurds, and then went up into the mountains to meet some of the PKK leadership, the Turkish wing, so to speak, of the Kurdish independent groups. And they too were saying, yeah, we think we're getting there with Turkey.
Yes.
Our war, we hope, is over.
Yes.
And we're not going to continue fighting. And we will accept that we will be Turkish Kurds. We will live in Turkey. There will be this theoretical border. We can cross it, and we will, you know, we will be able to fraternize with our fellow Kurds, and hopefully in Syria and Iran too. And that might be more. And it was fascinating to see that. And extreme. I was enthused and thought, this is marvelous. You know, the PKKs were more preoccupied with environmental issues and gender politics than fighting in a war of independence.
But you see, why this is the bottom of that is what Gabriel and I have been writing for some time now, that one has to be very practical and realistic.
Yeah.
The Levant will not move forward if you don't have an understanding of sort between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That is much more important than anything Moscow and Washington could say. And that is, I think, is, you know, having walked from east to west, so to speak, I think that's what it is. You know, we are in a different time, and the leadership of those two countries, we've been in touch in the last 6 months more than ever before in the previous 16 years, I think may be so courageous and so, you know, lead us in a way that they can do it. And then they will have to rebuild the architecture of the Levant from Lebanon to Pakistan, because we're not speaking here about Pakistan, but let's be very honest, Pakistan has, you know, a couple of hundred little toys to say boom boom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And those toys are there. So that is more than just, you know, I happen to have been when the great marriage took place in 1978. You know, the marriage between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, which was a fundamental change on the entire region. But nobody talks about it. But that was a great change, and it was a fundamental restructuring of the relationship. I think that if you don't have Iran and Saudi Arabia really having the courage of saying we can, you know, show the way and relate to each other in a way which they've never done so far. They've been so antagonistic for so long, and maybe they can find the way to do it. And I think that it's not impossible. You know, but this banality and this, you know, story about, you know, everything that you want something, so you go and just destroy, you know. Animals destroy all the time, and also build. And frankly, I don't want to belong to that kind of people who want to destroy.
But
And so rapidly, and this is the interesting thing about your thoughts on the commanders and immediates who all be embedded, who would have perhaps have a much more subtle understanding than a visiting journalist, as I might have done. But also your question about, just as politicians will be reacting to public opinion if they're fed it, they will make our policy on them. I guess also broadcasters, publishers, etc., will respond, what is the interest in? Well, we have gone slightly off the boil on ISIS, etc. this week. Kobani thing, which is, you know, has been dominant. It's calm, well, it seems to have calmed up, as far as we know, purely by what the headlines would be saying. So it's very hard to keep a thought going about what the world is.
But perhaps around just that question then. How did you get on as authors to working together?
You met in Tehran and you're now sitting in between you in the Freud Museum. How did you find working together on such an intimate thing, bringing this book together?
No comment.
You are a diplomat after all.
No, don't insult me now, please.
Okay, carry on.
No! Well, we are still here. We are alive. You know, it's the first step.
I think it's true to say that, actually, all the books I've done, I'm co-authored, and I would rather co-author a book, because actually, it's a place really to share ideas. But I think for us, it was never fun. I mean, I can remember, I was going to say, do you think we should have spoken to the Taliban in 2002? Mm-hmm. And then you'd kind of give a whole kind of sense of history and background. So there were never kind of any disagreements about really quite fundamental ideas of the kind of thing we're trying to understand in terms of human behaviour. I mean, I write, just the act of writing together has its own complexities and challenges, and, you know, I can remember Gianni having a virus on his computer once that inserted new things, or things like that.
And then I don't speak English, so, you know, it was difficult to write in a different language.
Yeah. The truth is whatever you do, and in fact part of the creative energy is around the tensions, yes, and the difficulties, yeah, and the having to resolve things, and it's sort of the point, you know, the very fact that we're working in conflict resolution, let's never pretend there isn't conflict. That's the nature of any kind of interaction, but the struggle is, what can you do about it?
I've never written this alone, never.
Okay.
I've never written this alone without my English-speaking co-author.
But the thing, I wrote a book with Brian Keenan, the Irish guy I spent 4 years in Lebanon, and this was not a book about captivity, but about being free to travel the world again. And it was fascinating. We, you know, survived phenomenally well together, great sense of humour, etc., and seen each other through obviously very difficult times. And then out on the road, the real relationship had to be developed and bubbled up. And I do remember writing and then waiting for the email to come through with Brian with his chapter or whatever. When is that so-and-so ever going to deliver something? And then his flattery me, I'd written a piece a section that he really admired. And all he emailed out was saying, that's all right.
Yes.
In fact, it's very good. In fact, I'd like to switch your throat. that positive feedback, I don't quite know where we're going. I think we should wind up there.
I think probably.
Okay.
I mean, it's been fascinating.
Well, and Johnny and Gabrielle will be here, obviously, now, and signing books or chatting as we all leave. But it's been my privilege to sit up here and lead the conversation this evening. Thank you again, Carol, for having us all here. Thank you all for coming, especially Johnny and Gabrielle. Thank you so much for sharing.